is Nikki Salter, and this project, RSA in Conversation, sort of came about through, I think, me just being quite nosy and wanting to know more about individual people locally. And also this year, particularly with quite a concentration on women, because sometimes we don't get to hear enough of individual women's lives. So this very important woman who's coming today to talk to us, I'm delighted to welcome Vicky Hayward, CBE. Vicky is currently RSA chair, and I am looking at the detail of her main points of her CV and her life that's put on the RSA website. And it's one of those lives where when you read it, look at it, the first feeling is, oh, a very impressive person who's done an enormous range of things. And the idea of these interviews is really to talk to the person and get to know how somebody does some of these things and what drives them, what motivates them, what they're interested in, and what the future holds for them, and to commune with the afterlife at the same time.
Just a little thing I do.
Thank you for that. I think one of the header on this is quite interesting, and it makes me want to ask this question straight away, but I will read a few things out first. So Vicky was appointed for a second three-year term as chair at the AGM of the RSA in October 2015, and this was the first time ever that the chair had been invited to remain. So that makes me fascinated to know more about Vicky, and also to know what happened to the others and why were they previously, Vicky was the executive director of the Royal Shakespeare Company, a position she stepped down from just recently in 2013. And since leaving the RSC, she has not been quiet and taking a back seat. She's taken on the chairmanship of the RSA, the Warwick Commission on the Future of Cultural Value, which published January 2015, Mount View Drama Academy, which I look forward to hearing more about, and 1418 Now, which is the five-year First World War Centenary Arts Commissioning Programme. There's a very long title for you. And I heard just before, when we were talking beforehand, that the title was changed to 1418 Now, which sounds like a much better title to me. Prior to joining the RSC, Vicky was Joint Chief Executive of the Royal Court Theatre, which is known for new writing within the UK's theatre world. She's also was a board member previously of the Society of London Theatre, the London 2012 Cultural Olympiad, the Coventry and Warwickshire Local Enterprise Partnership, and a member of Warwick University Council, and lots of other stuff as well, but we'll find out some of that. She has been awarded an honorary doctorate from the University of Birmingham and was awarded a CBE in the Queen's Birthday Honours in 2012 for services to theatre. So welcome to Bristol, and thank you very much for giving us this time. We really appreciate it. I would like to start from the beginning of the story, because I always think about the RSA as being a place of... we do a lot of work thinking about education, so I'm always interested to know how the person has been formed, and where did you come from, and what was your early life like?
Well, my home life consisted of being brought up by a father who was a writer, so I was very a writer for television, scriptwriter. So I was very used to a world in which my dad would disappear into his office in our house in London, or into the garden shed, actually, in our other house, which was in Cornwall, and work away and not be disturbed. Although occasionally he would arrive in my bedroom and steal back, as far as I was concerned, all his pencils and pens, which had study typed on them and stuck on with bits of cellophane. So he would occasionally raid my room for all the stuff that I'd gone to his room and raided for mine. So I was very used to the concept of someone kind of working away, creating something within our household, and then switching on the telly and watching his work of an evening. So that was quite normal for me, which I was sort of increasingly beginning to realise is not necessarily how everybody's life is. But we moved around quite a lot because Dad could just move his typewriter, which sort of progressed from a lovely old one to a golf ball to finally, the first word processor. So our lives batted backwards from wars between Cornwall and London. My educational achievements are remarkably unimpressive. I spent far too much time fighting school rather than being good at school. I was sent to quite a sciencey school, which was just the one that was closest to us, was very science orientated. So I don't think they understood me, and I didn't really understand them. My
was
younger
that,
brother
was that in
Simon,
London?
In Cornwall. My younger brother Simon had a better time because he was much more maths orientated and sciencey than I was. But I just enjoyed being a problem, really. And so I left school at 16 with a very, very small number of O levels, which included domestic science and music. And was lucky enough then to go to a school in London where I met an extraordinarily inspirational headmaster, head of sixth form, called Lionel Warne, who actually had been a producer at the BBC. And Lionel taught me what education was all about and believed in me. And suddenly everything started to change for me from that point onwards. So I owe him an enormous debt of gratitude. And I'm sure everyone in this room has got a Lionel. That's the wonderful thing about educators. It sort of doesn't matter whether they find you when you're 50 or whether you were six, you know, they happen. And so he was really the first person who made me, apart from my parents, who made me have a sense of myself and what I could become. And that I didn't have to be good at maths and physics to be counted in the world.
That's interesting, isn't it? How strong that was in our generation, and how I think it still can be quite strong, actually, that the leaning that away from arts, and the fact that art is always that arts can be a secondary.
Yeah, and given that it was part of my home life, you know, going to the theatre, you know, off to Stratford with my parents to be taken to see some things that were more interesting than others. I remember a particularly grim matinee performance of Henry IV, Part 2, that probably very nearly killed my interest in Shakespeare for the rest of my life. You know, given that that was my home life, it was a real shock to be in a creative environment in where those sort of things weren't particularly encouraged or valued. I mean, it was, you know, you did your English, didn't you? But it wasn't really what was most important in life. And that's not to say that science isn't incredibly important, and all education is very valid. And as I've grown older, I've been able to become much more interested in those subjects that at the time I felt incredibly dry and difficult to. I think that was partly because I was very, I still am, I kind of need to see the point, you know, and I just couldn't get the point of a lot of this stuff. I couldn't get the point of logarithms or algebra. I just couldn't get how it was going to be useful to me. Whereas other things, I could see where they could take me and how they would be useful, which is why in the end I chose a vocational training course.
So where did you go from, what did your sort of sixth form time, because it was like an inspirational time for you where you were finding yourself, where did that, what path did that lead you down then? How did you, what happened when you left school? Did you know what you wanted to do?
Not at all. No, not at all. I spent an awful lot of... It's funny how it's always... I'm on the sofa and my mum and dad are talking to me and it's all getting quite uncomfortable and I'm slightly getting hot and I don't know what it is I'm supposed to be answering, but I don't know what I want to do. And I was always brought up to believe that, you know, you could do anything. But of course that's a rather... That's a very big open door then. So it might be easier to know that they wanted you to be, you know, a doctor, and then at least I don't know what path they wanted me to take. And they weren't particularly pushing me towards a creative vocational idea at all. But on the other hand, I was kind of floating along really and not really knowing what to do. And I think more in desperation than anything else, my dad took me down to the Central School of Speech and Drama to watch a show. And I couldn't believe that I could possibly spend 2 years as a stage management course there just being part of that. I didn't want to act. I knew I didn't want to act, but I suddenly really started to think about what was going on behind the scenes and read up about that. And it was run at the time by the Inner London Education Authorities, and I wanted to go somewhere that where I would be amongst a whole group of people from different social backgrounds, which wasn't necessarily the case at the drama school when I was growing up. So it was important to me that I went somewhere like that, like Central. And I was very, very lucky and got in. They take 14 people. Well, they took, at that time, 14 people.
What did you have to do to get in? Did you have to do an audition?
I had to pass an interview. I got, you know, How they choose stage managers, I don't know. But all I can tell you is that anyone who has trained as a stage manager, whether they go on into stage management for the rest of their lives or whether they do it for a while like me and then they go off and do something else, all live very interesting lives because I think we're all motivated by the desire to want to make things happen for other people as part of a group of people. So they tend to be highly collaborative people. And quite well organised and all of those things. So stage managers, I find, I go around, there may even be one lurking in this room, someone who trains as a stage manager who's then gone off to do something completely different in their life. But we kind of all know each other and the type that we are tends to attract certain people. So they obviously worked that out about me. And I had a fantastic time there for 2 years and graduated in 1977.
And why, you mentioned that you were interested in meeting people, making sure that your environment had a diverse group of people in. That's an interesting thing to have specifically mentioned. Where does that come from? What was driving you then?
I think all our meal times, lots of our meal times as a family were about talking about how the world was, where there was inequity, where social justice was important and where it might be missing. Both my parents sort of moved in and out of the Labour Party to the SDP and then to the Liberal Democrats. My brother is a Liberal Democrat politician. All of my life was about being interested in what was going on around the world and how could one make the world a better place. And there's always been a sense in our family that, you should contribute to that in whatever way that you can. That's part of being a citizen, if you like. So I've always wanted to be in places where I felt that people had a sense of common spirit and, sort of collective support, and also a place where every person would have a voice and that their opinion would be heard and be listened to, because that's what my family is like. Mm. We didn't agree an awful lot with her. Terrible rows. Big rows.
And so when you... So you left... After school, you had this, opportunity, magical opportunity. It sounds like it absolutely fitted your personality to find stage management and go, this is the thing that I can do. Did you then go straight into theatre and do stage managing, or did you...
Yeah, no, I was really, really lucky I got picked up. The production manager of Salisbury Playhouse at that time would come to London and he would interview all 14 of the technical year, and he had one equity card to give away, and in those days you couldn't get a job if you didn't have an equity card, and you couldn't get an equity card unless you had a job, so I had to get an equity card and a job all at the same time, and he took me on as a provisional equity member, and then you become a full equity member sort of 6 months later. So I went to Salisbury and was an assistant stage manager.
And was it what you expected?
Yes, it was. It was. It was blinking hard work. But then drama school was hard work. I can remember, my legs aching on the way. And I mean, they really made you work like you were working. It wasn't a kind of nice, cosy thing, and it's still the case at Mountview. Our students get 36 contact hours a week. Well, my son at Warwick University got 6. And there's nothing wrong with what Warwick University doing, but a vocational course is a completely different experience. You are there to learn how to do a job. So I was jolly glad. They asked me at my interview if I would know how to make a replica of the Magna Carta, and so I said yes, blagged on about it, and then get there on my first week, and that's the first job. I really can't do anything. Anyway, it's all right because I nipped along to the shop at the cathedral and they sold them. I took it back, put a lot of old tea all over it, and got away with it. So, first lesson in life, you're gonna blag on about your creative ability, you better jolly well have a really creative way of solving the problem. You actually can't do beautiful handwriting.
It's difficult, actually, isn't it, when you're talking to younger people about what happens when you first go to the first job or whatever, because, sometimes it's sort of blatant lying, and you think, how do I can't really...
Yeah, I can't actually
somebody
type.
..to do that, but I remember saying to somebody who asked me, you have a computer, and I went, yes, I have no computer, but next day I went, it's terribly sorry, my computer seems to have gone down. Having already learnt the lingo, you know. And so I'm so, well, I'm sure we can find one for you here. And luckily those days I also found with it a secretary who showed me how to turn it on. And I was way.
Absolutely.
But yes, a bit of just going for it is really...
Yeah, yeah, no, I blagged my way into being a telephonist. And I was looking for a temp job, and one of those old ones where you've got, you know, 20 incoming things and 100 lines. Well, someone had told me how to do it on 5. So that's all right. But anyway, this was 20, and I mean, oh my God, I cut everybody off. It was the most, and you get electric shocks from these things as well. I had the most terrifying day of my life. Yeah, the agency replaced me with somebody else. Yeah.
Very embarrassing. So did you have a, from looking back, you could sort of say, oh yeah, so that's the path and that's the path. Did you have a feeling that you had an ambition to become head of a theatre, or did you have any feeling of where you were going at that time?
No, well, in the end, I got sort of trapped in the basement of the Barbican, working for the RSC as a stage manager. Because stage management is very like the army. It's sort of, you know, assistant, deputy, stage, company, and then you are a company manager for the rest of your life, and there are many people who do this, and they are phenomenal human beings. But I got to be company manager at the RSC rather fast, through a sort of series of happenstances, really, and done some foreign touring, which was absolutely fantastic. So I got to see extraordinary parts of the world. But then I was back at the Barbican, with no windows, 4 floors underground, and feeling quite... depressed about that fact. And I started plotting with a friend of mine called Sue Storr, who was the administrator running the Pitt Theatre. She'd run the Donmar Warehouse when the RSC used to run the Donmar Warehouse. And she'd ended up in the Pitt, so that was quite a big shock change for her. We started to plot how we might get out. And she broke out first and got a job as general manager running a touring theatre company called Payne's Plough, who are still very successful, creating new work. And,
so is it quite hard even to move from stage management to something else?
Very hard. And I was beginning to think that I'd like to change tracks. I was big-headed enough to think that I could possibly run the RSC better than it was being run at the time. I felt as I was at the sort of nub end of quite a lot of decisions that I just didn't think were really being made for the best of reasons. So... I really wanted to get out of that time, and Sue, I went to see her for a cup of tea, and she'd added up all the money in her petty cash tin and said she could employ me as an assistant administrator for 6 months. So I took a massive pay cut and went to work for Sue at the top of a flight of about 20 million stairs in the Tottenham Court Road. And there were three little offices heated by one Calla gas heater that we used to move around to share, and that was Payne's Plough, joint stock, as it was in those times, and shared experience. So suddenly I was part of this kind of really interesting, lively community with writers coming in and directors walking past, and it was so much more what I wanted to do than being kind of right at the sort of far end of just calling people onto a stage and not feeling that I was any more really contributing to their creative experience.
Mm-hmm. And what was the status of those jobs? You know, how did it feel being... You said you took a big pay cut. Did you feel like you took a status cut? Or was that
well, no, because it was just me and Sue and Pip Broughton in a room, and we had to make it all happen. So it was fantastic. I was doing, you know, everything. And at that time, I went to a lecture at the Arts Council, and they talked about these American beings called development directors who raised money from trusts and foundations and businesses. And so I thought, well, how hard can that be? I'll call myself development director at the bottom instead of assistant administrator and start writing to people and asking them to support our work. And actually we got, you know, reasonable sums, bits of money started to come in. So then I started getting a name for myself as someone who could raise money for organisations. And then I got approached to run the London Bubble Theatre Company. So I then went off and sort of took on my first grown-up company where I was actually really running the thing. And that then took me off into theatre management.
And so how long did you stay within theatre management before taking on any other sorts of roles? Because you've got a lot of interesting external roles now that link with all sorts of different things.
I think what happens to you, if you end up running something like the Royal Shakespeare Company or the National Theatre, then you increasingly find yourself place in a situation, whether it's on platforms or being asked to join organisations, where you are actually taking on a wider, more civic role than just running the organisation. So quite quickly after I arrived at the RSC, I was asked if I'd like to join the board of Warwick University, and then I was asked to join the LEP, and as well as part of running the RSC, I had to sort out the fact that we owned a hotel opposite the theatre that nobody had been paying any attention to since 1926, and the plumbing looked like that. and I knew nothing about how to run a hotel, so that was, and the RSC owns, you know, a large amount of property in Stratford-upon-Avon, so it's got many different skills to it that you need to do as that job. So I found myself, you know, being rung up saying, the Prime Minister's having breakfast with a whole group of very important arts people on Friday, you know, can you be there? And you would rush down there thinking, what on earth am I supposed to say? So you start to represent your community, and you start also to have an important responsibility as part of your civic role. And of course in Stratford, it's a very, very major employer in a small market town in Warwickshire. Mm. So, you know, what the RSC does impacts enormously. If we decide we're not going to have any matinee performances anymore, you know, half the restaurants are ringing me up saying, what's going on? So you're not just a, you know, you're not just living in your own bubble. So that's, as it were, took me into a life where I had a more, set of a wider, more civic and educational relationships.
And when you, so you were back at the RSC then, having been there as a tiny underling.
I was the girl who went back to become the headmistress of our own school. Well, I can't really comment about whether it was, I mean, the staff ought to say whether they were sitting in their offices saying, well, I could do it a lot better than this. Mm. When I arrived, Michael Boyd asked me to go and help him. He just arrived as artistic director. I think it's no secret that the RSC, for a whole series of reasons that were no one individual's fault, had found itself in quite a pickle. It had a major capital project in Stratford which had stalled, and it had stalled because people in Stratford didn't like it, but it also had stalled because the Arts Council didn't like it, Heritage Lottery Fund didn't like it, English Heritage, who were in charge of protection of buildings, didn't like it, and worst of all, none of the actors liked it.
Oops.
So it was really, that was in big trouble. Adrian Noble had just stepped down as artistic director after, it was very unfair because actually Adrian ran an enormously successful company, but he just happened to have a very unfortunate year, and so quite a lot of money had got lost. And also the company had launched itself probably too fast and too ruthlessly into a very, very big change programme, which did not really have the support of the staff behind it. And so it found itself in a sort of perfect storm of everybody having a view and board members wishing they hadn't been invited to dinner with their best friends on Saturday, because what on earth were they going to say, because their best friends were definitely going to have a view. So Michael had arrived and he was looking for someone to join him as the executive director to really turn the company around. And we set out on a project to do that, which included a really big think about the culture of the organisation and how to create a place that where everybody felt that they were contributing and that everyone felt that their contribution was as important as each other. And that was something that we set about doing, and I think after 10 years, which was by the time we both stepped down, I think we felt that we'd really achieved quite a lot there. And we actually were part of a report that was written called All Together Now, which was created by Demos, talking about how you successfully change cultures of organisations and how you do make people feel valuable. And that's particularly difficult in a place where, quite clearly, we are all working every day towards 7:30 at night, and a group of actors who are going out there on stage, you know, I don't have to go out there on stage, they're the ones who actually have to go out there on stage and face that audience. So clearly, they are a fundamental part of the success of that company. But I hope we got to the point where everybody could see how they played their part towards that 7:30 moment and got genuine pleasure out of doing that.
And do you think the change on the inside of what does the change on the inside of the organisation, What does that look like? Or how, what's the effect of that for the public and the organisation, the way in which it impacts?
Well, we were lucky in the sense that because everything had gone slightly awry and they'd given notice on the Barbican, so they were sort of operating peripatetically in London, and also they had a large amount of money set aside by the Arts Council, but not really a clear plan of what to do in Stratford. We were able actually to look at the whole, I'm going to use that B word, brand identity of the organisation in every possible way. So the building, the way that we approached the building itself in Stratford was to turn it as far as we possibly could inside out, so that it was much more porous, that you could approach it from every angle and you could find a way in, that if you just happened to pop in for a cup of tea and buy something for Auntie Mabel, you might just pick up a leaflet and think, I could go and see a show, or you take your child to an exhibition there. So it's far, far, far more going on in the building for the people of Stratford, the people of Warwickshire and the people of the UK, who might not necessarily have ever found their way through that door. And that's really revolutionised the relationship between the company and its audience. And then we created an auditorium which was much more democratic, where there are good seats on all levels. Actually, if you're at the back of the stalls, you're not having nearly as good a time as you are if you're at the middle of the circle. So it turned people's perceptions around about segregation and audiences and how ticket pricing works. Mm-hmm. So that the whole thing was about a sense of community, audience, artists, and the company itself.
Is that something you feel you create? So do you feel like that is one of your roles in life, to create community?
Well, it sort of become it. And I suppose that was what was interesting about taking on the RSA, which is perhaps the biggest possible extension of that challenge. And I felt that I learned a lot at the RSC about how to do that. And I saw in the RSA an organisation which, to some extent, was struggling a bit with the same kind of challenges. You know, what's it there to do? How should it do it? And how does it communicate that and engage a very wide group of people on that journey? And it's a massive challenge, actually, which has all sorts of interesting pieces and parts to it. But I felt that I kind of knew it a bit. I knew some of those challenges from what I'd experienced at the RSC, so I suppose that did give me the confidence to say I'll throw my hat in the ring and see if I could become chairman.
And how did the RSA, did you know about the organisation already?
I was already a fellow.
Oh, you were.
I wasn't an active fellow. I kind of, you know, I'd occasionally go onto the website, although in those days the website wasn't much to go on, frankly. It's revolutionised now. And that's really, you know, thanks to the board really saying, look, we're going to invest a lot of money in this, because actually if we're going to really speak to people all over the world about how you can make the world a better place, you better be able to do that. And it was a rather, I mean, I think that was one of the things that surprised me when I got there, was for an organisation that talked about 21st enlightenment and how to create change in the world. I mean, there was an awful lot of sealing wax and string in that place. I mean, it's still, you know, it's still a challenge, that building, because it's five buildings all stuck together. In fact, I think in my first few months, someone said, of course, you know what you should do. You should just put all five houses on the market, sell them, make a pile of money, and create the most fantastic space somewhere else in London where fellows can visit from all over the country and all over the world, and you've got this great, you know, hub of invention and da-da-da-da-da, and it'd be just the most... I was getting really, really into this, and then I thought, no. The next chairman could do that. I'm not the one that's going to say, after how many hundreds of years, we're out of here, guys. But it is a real problem, because that building is an enormous challenge, and the staff actually operate up in the servants' quarters at the top of the building, and it's boiling hot, and each one is in a tiny little office, and it's crazy. You would never, ever design the RSA in terms of what it stands for and put it really into a building like that.
One thing that's quite interesting about, I was thinking when you were talking about the RSA being the centre of this huge world organisation, that of course if you made it into a different building, it would be in London. And yet it's interesting that the RSC has managed to stay at Stratford and is one of the few sort of real centres of arts that is not in London. And speaking from the position of Bristol, and I live further out into the country between here and Cornwall, that sometimes we are quite starved. You know, things are still very London centric. Is that? What do you think about that?
I think it's an enormous challenge, and I think that building, in a way, creates a false vision of what the RSA should be. Of course, that building and its history is incredibly important, but actually, the most of our work is carrying on in rooms all over the country and indeed all over the world. And particularly now, because fellows can actually communicate with each other on our website, people are getting on with stuff up there. Mm-hmm. And I think up there is going to be the most important place for everyone. You know, there are lots of, as we know, downsides about the internet. And there's a lot of talk these days about fake news and fake communication and how do you find out what's really going on in the world. And I think the fellowship creates an enormous opportunity for us to make sure that there are forums where people can go to find to have conversations about what's really going on. And we are still at the early stages of that. Mm. There's still quite a lot of investment that needs to happen in our kit of parts to be able to really get to be, I think, operating forward, in a forward way for the 21st century. But the conversation that's going on from fellows now is fantastic because we're getting more and more ideas about how to solve that problem from the fellowship rather than the organisation itself constantly thinking, oh gosh, we've got to solve all of this. And I do think that that is something that has definitely changed in the 3 years that I've been chairman, now going into my fourth, which is that the level of that of the communication, the sharing of the challenge, the desire to want to co-create solutions, the growing number of fellows and the growing number of younger fellows means that we are, I think, for the first time now, really able to think quite cleverly about what the future what the future of what the RSA should all be about. That said, I'll be measured, I think, on this, in that I said when I arrived right at the beginning that I thought it was unclear what the RSA was. I thought the fellows needed far more guidance from the organisation itself and from the board about the areas that we should be concentrating on, that they'd become it had become rather opaque. And it had certainly become opaque because I think, and I still think, that some of our language is too highfalutin, it's too difficult for people to understand. We have a whole range of markets that we're talking to, from me, with my cookery O-level, through to people who've got, you know, 3 degrees and are the forefront of scientific research in the world. So we have to find a way of talking to everyone, and I think we sometimes still struggle with that. So I hope by the time I go, it will be clearer to fellows what the RSA is all about. I hope we'll have more fellows than we did when I arrived, and I hope we'll be able to demonstrate clear pathways for people to be able to connect with each other, to convene and to create change.
And how do you think women are doing within the RSA?
As I look about me, whether I'm walking through the doors or if I'm at an event out and about around the country, or I'm tracking what's going on the web, I would say women are quite well represented. I'm not sure that we particularly address the world from a woman's perspective, or that we particularly look at challenges that women face in the world. And I think that's something that we should consider. But actually, I was looking at a blog only on the train on the way up, which had been generated as a result of International Women's Day. And I thought, no, I think there is actually quite a lot going on. I hope the atmosphere, when people turn up to events or whether they suggest a proposal for something, feels empowering for women. The board is certainly very representative of women. And that's great to see that happening through the election process, because the board is 50% elected by the fellows and 50% co-opted. And interestingly, more women put themselves up for election and are getting elected onto the board than used to be the case. And so that room feels very equal.
I'm interested in the idea of the positive change and the social change that has sort of been part of your life all the way through, right from the beginning. Looking at the RSA and perhaps more broadly arts and culture, do you still think that, or have you always thought that they are a part of the move for social change, so that arts and culture actually contribute to that strongly?
I think my perception of that has, I mean, I didn't start off thinking that. I suppose I went into a creative world because I really enjoyed being around creative people. But increasingly, as I've gone through my career, I've realised that I need to find ways to articulate this, that sometimes it feels, and I've had to point this out within the RSA itself, that a report can be produced which actually doesn't really highlight the contribution that arts and culture can play to the civic society. And that actually, if you look at every successful nation or region or city or town or village, you will find a very thriving creative cultural life within that. And then, of course, you expand that into the role of culture and creativity in education and how important that is to take that through, not just at primary, but vitally into secondary. So I found myself more and more on platforms and running organisations that where that is at the root of why they exist. Mm. You talked about 1418 now. We've just last night had a board meeting at which we sat and looked at our results from 2016. So this is an organisation that is there to commission works of art in all art forms. So that can be poetry, music, dance, circus, to commemorate the First World War. And it was created by Maria Miller, so I answered directly to the Secretary of State. It was a very, very inspired idea on her part to really, sort of from the seeds of the Cultural Olympiad, to say, how should Britain recognise and commemorate this centenary? So we didn't have a name. We started in 2013 with no name, a bit of money, and a few ideas. And a relatively sceptical artistic community going, oh, I don't know, what's this government programme? Anyway, here we are, 2016. We've raised and continue to raise quite extraordinary sums of money to be able to commission artists, to bring arts organisations together who perhaps have never worked together before. We set ourselves a target that 10 million people would have participated in our projects by the time we got to the end. So far, 30 million people have participated in the projects that we've done.
Wow.
And we're having a greater impact on people's emotional connection and intellectual connection and remembrance of the First World War than any other programme that's happened before. Bristol took part in 2016 with the Ghost Soldiers, which was Jeremy Deller's inspired work. It wasn't just an inspired piece of work in terms of the idea, but also it brought together the National Theatres of England, Scotland and Wales, who have never worked together before, along with a whole range of arts organisations right all over the country, and involved volunteers dressing up as soldiers on the first day of the Battle of the Somme, and being in public spaces, whether that was train stations or supermarkets, that's what I was saying, shopping centres and all sorts of unusual places where you wouldn't expect to see them. 63% of the British population were aware of the fact that it was the 100-year centenary of the Battle of the Somme as a result of that project. Mm. So that, for me, brings everything beautifully together because it's absolutely about artists approaching through their own inspiration an idea of how they would like to engage the British public in a creative and cultural commemoration of the First World War. And the members of the British public becoming involved and engaged in a national commemoration through an act of creativity. That, for me, is a sort of perfect fulcrum of why a creative society is so important, because it enables you to live a more full life.
And part of presumably getting there is having young people not just sort of skilled up to be able to participate in that, but also to know that it even exists. And I see that, you know, I'd like to know a bit more about Mount View, because it looks as if that's geared towards young people and it's about you know, theatre education.
Yeah.
And also that looks like it's developing into an enormous project.
Well, Mount View is a very interesting drama school. It's one of the top drama schools in the country, but it's sort of it's been rather quiet about it. It's also the most accessible drama school in the UK. And by that I mean that kids from all walks of life get the opportunity to come and study with us, partly because we go out and find them, and partly because we have a wonderful thing we can offer them called the Dance and Drama Awards, which is the last old grant. So they don't leave Mount View with a huge debt. Their fees are paid, and their accommodation is paid as well. So if you're a kid in Newcastle and you're means tested and you have extraordinary talent, because you've got to fight your way through to get onto one of our courses, but we have ways of finding you and helping you, and you're helped a great deal while you're there. So it's a great thing. I took it on because I went to drama school, I got suckered to go in for a cup of tea with the principal, and I only had to walk through the door to suddenly think, oh, goodness, I haven't done anything about drama training for the whole of my career, and I really ought to put something back. And it changed my life. It's never had a home. It's existed for 70 years, and it's round the back of the gasworks in Wood Green, and it desperately needed a new home. So more for me, having said I wouldn't do another capital project, I found myself now sorting out a new home for all these kids. But we've done it, and we're going to be opening a brand new school in Peckham in 2018, and we're only £3.5 million to go on fundraising. We have a total project cost of £28.5 million. But it will be an extraordinary place, because it will not only train these kids, but it will also be a hub for artists. It will have its own theatre, it's got a fully professional rehearsal room, it's got 21 dance studios, it will also be a community space. So it's, I think, going to create a different kind of drama training. I think it will become a model of best practice in the UK. But there's a real opportunity there, actually, because we need to find ways to open up our business to a much wider community of kids. And we also need to make sure, just as we were talking earlier about universities and the role they need to play in their civic role and arts organisation. So a drama school should play its civic role. And we found a wonderful local authority in Southwark who actually really care about this stuff. So everything that we wanted to do, they wanted to do, and they actually had a piece of land they could give us. So we've been very, very lucky.
It's funny that in some way the RSA is it's quite a sort of sprawling, very broad organisation,
yeah,
isn't it? And sometimes I don't know whether you feel the same, but I feel it's almost a frustration about what does it do? It must be more focused. But in another way, our lives are sprawling and disparate. And somehow, if you allow it to be like that, maybe you can pull more stuff in. And
I think it's the tension line for the RSA is always going to be there. You know, it has to in some way define what it means. by the change that it's looking for. It must do that, otherwise you're just in a lot of rooms talking around in circles and never deciding anything. So it needs to, the institution itself needs to lead, and it is influenced, it is enormously influenced in that by its fellows. I mean, all the board is fellows, and half the board's been elected by the fellows, and we have a fellowship council which also can help, which also does help and advise on what we should be concentrating on. So it's porous, but it needs to lead. And at the same time, if it gets too dogmatic and rigorous and doesn't sort of allow itself to trip over that line a little bit, you're never going to allow fellows to come along and say, but actually, you know, I'm going to say something really important and you've all got to listen. And therefore, the yin and the yang of this is the trick. And I think in Matthew, you have an extraordinary chief executive who lives that tension every day between listening to what he is being told and being influenced by that and saying, this is what we need to concentrate on. And I think a good relationship between the fellows and the board and the executive is that we're all quite comfortable now with that kind of pulling and pushing around, and that there isn't a sense that any one of those is dogmatically sat there saying, I'm not going to... Sorry, I said I wasn't going to bounce, and I am. But isn't it being dogmatic about that? Whereas at the beginning, it kind of, when I arrived, it felt all a bit kind of like everyone was kind of pulling in slightly different directions, and there wasn't really a facing forward. And I went round, I did a sort of grand tour of all the regions I met up with fellows, and it was fantastic, because I was thinking, gosh, how do I say, I really think the problem is the RSA isn't being clear enough about what you should be doing as fellows. How am I going to say this without bums, you know, coming back at me and everyone getting very hot under the collar? And guess what everyone said to me? Will the RSA please be clearer about what it wants us to do? Great! This is it. This is actually fantastic. There isn't a problem. We just need to get on with it now.
And is there a, looking globally, because you said it's a global organisation, are there other RSA-type organisations in the world that the RSA works with? Or is it a sort of isolated network, if you see what I mean? I know individually we all connect with loads and loads of other things as fellows, probably. It's in our nature. But, you know, how does the RSA overlay onto...
I think it's got a long way in having a content conversation up there on our website. We know. I mean, our website is seen by people all over the world. We know we are influencing them. In their millions, they watch us. And that's fantastic. But how the RSA outside of the UK really forms its useful institutional relationships, and fellows create their own useful individual relationships, is all part of a big conversation that was going on at the Away Day a couple of months ago, and I think is going to become a very important strand going forward. Because we do have international fellows, and we now have someone who is responsible for a global RSA within the organisation, and we have an advisory committee. And I think that the next piece is going to be about how we really live the ambition. Because I think if you're in Bristol, you want to be having a conversation both with other Bristolians, both with people in the southwest, but actually you're also incredibly interested about how people solve this problem in Kuala Lumpur. Otherwise we're just going around in circles and we're not finding out actually that Fred knows how to do it all along. So that feels to me, when that becomes normal, which is probably the next chairman, but when the organisation and the fellowship is behaving like that's normal, instead of us remembering to go, oh, yes, and global, we will really be living the ambition that we have. But it takes a while. It takes time. And I think we had to get stronger and clearer in the UK and start to get that model of fellowship, of fellows working together and fellowship projects really zinging along, in order to be able to say, okay, well, if that's the model at home base, then what is it? What could that be elsewhere?
Thank you. We're probably going to stop soon and have some questions, if you've all got questions to go. And I've only got sort of one question to finish off with, which is taking it back to personal again.
Yeah.
I'm quite interested to know, because you've moved around quite a bit and you've lived in various places for quite long periods of time, how do have you taken many friends with you? Do you have many friends? Who are your mates?
I have taken my friends with me. Somebody was talking to me the other day, I was on a panel, and they said, you know, so how do you have a work-life balance? And I said, I don't think you do. And that's actually one reason why I'm not running, you know, a full-time major institution anymore. It was great to run the Royal Court, and it was great to run the RSC, but that was 20 years of my life, and I dedicated my life to that. I happen to have, in steps and children, seven children and five step-grandchildren now, but I've sort of found them along the way. Of my life. So, I do have good friends, and I have always... I've never been afraid to pick up the telephone and ask somebody else if they know the answer to the problem that I've got. It's a bit like the Magna Carta thing. I think I don't think that it's a female thing, but I think that there are some people who would just find that easier than others, and I've always done it. And people do it to me, so I've always been very sort of generous with my advice where I can give it, and I've always been very open at ringing up other people and going, I don't know what, I'm taking the show to Broadway, and I'm, why have you ever taken the show to Broadway, and how did you do it? And I think, you know, that's the most important thing. That's what keeps your friends with you, is having time for them.
Thank you, it was lovely. I've really enjoyed talking to you. I could carry on, actually, but I'm not trying not to be selfish. So I will say thank you so far, and please, let's open, if you're happy to answer some questions, let's see if anyone in the audience would like to ask a question.
Let's go with John. I can thank you and the RSA for delivering the most extraordinary experience, the most extraordinary day of my life. Okay. 2004, 22nd of March, 2004, the 250th year anniversary, and the trustees of the day brilliantly decided to invite any of the fellows of those of that time to reenact the role of William Shipley in 1754, Walswell's Coffee House in Covent Garden, and I said, I'll do Bristol. And in doing Bristol, it became, well, I can look back on that, the most extraordinary day of my life. I'm living the best years, I should be 80 in a couple of months' time, I'm living the best years of my life since that day. It allowed me to park my under the bushel, I'm who am I, and all that sort of thing. And it allowed me to be, in a theatrical sense, picking up the phone, will you join me at Starbucks Coffee House in Bristol Bridge? And I ended up with 30 names. We had to have a morning session and an afternoon session at the Coffee House Challenge.
Yeah.
And I can trace everything back to that. And I can put the global context into your last few comments. The Converging World came out of that. This business here, the Bordeaux Key Restaurant, won the national prize for the Coffee House Challenge. The Duke of Edinburgh presented Barney Poulton and myself with the only prize. 65 of us did the reenacting the role of William Shipley, and I blessed the time where the brilliance of the trustees said, you have five manifested challenges if you're going to do this Coffee House conversation. Imagine you're William Shipley, turn yourself back, and it was the five manifested challenges, and the second one, moving towards a zero-waste society, picked up all the others,
yeah.
And we had riveting conversations, and that's led now to something called the Converging World.
Yeah.
The convergingworld.org is linking the southwest of England with the southeast of India. We're planting 40,000 trees a year in Tamil Nadu. Okay? We've got family there now. We are blessed, and we're starting to see African connections. The convergingworld.org, if you go onto the University of the West of England website and you look for the Brindia Report, Britain and India, in a collaboration, then you will see the researchers and the scientists at the University of the West coming up with 50 or 60 pages of the most extraordinary global climate change, global warming. We can sequester a ton of CO2 for a penny a ton in this model, or less than 1 rupee. So it is there. Brindia Report, get on to the University of the West of England, pick that up, it's published, it's peer reviewed. And this came out of me reenacting the role of William Shipley, and we have 30-odd mates in two separate sessions. I am really blessed. I'm thanking you now. No. I've never known how to say thank you, but I can say thank you for having heard what you've said today.
Well, thank you. That's brilliant. We were talking about the Coffee House Challenge.
Only the other day. Thank you for that brilliant testimony.
Penny.
That's amazing. I mean, it links to my esteemed colleague in front of me, but I was interested in, you know, I've witnessed personally and professionally the impact of, you know, being a member of this community. And I'm interested in it not being exclusive, that it's inclusive to young people as well, and how we do that. But I wondered, because obviously, yeah, I say thanks to people like Lou who've given birth to concepts around our projects, the Forest of Imagination, the House of Imagination, School Without Walls, the International Festival of Childhood. You know, they're all thanks to that moment where people believed in an idea and we've been supported in that process. But I wondered if you could say something about the creative learning and development strand of the RSA's work and how that links across the country but also internationally.
Yes, we're on a downer. Somebody said to me the other day, well, the RSA has been trying to influence improvements in education since it was formed, and if you look at the history of it, you know, hardly anything. We're still talking about the same problems. We still don't seem to be able to change anything. And oh, God, yeah, right. And I think that has... I think there is an opportunity for us to really do something about that in this piece of work, piece of research work that we're now embarking on in terms of whether or not we can measure the impact of creative learning in terms of children's academic performance at school. Now, this is quite a dangerous thing for us to do. And the road is quite bumpy, and there are some broken down vehicles on the way that we're passing of people who've tried to do this in the past and haven't necessarily achieved it. And that is not to say that there isn't an enormous amount of cultural and creative work that goes on educationally that has got nothing to do with attainment and is equally and absolutely as vital. But we have decided to throw our hats into the ring of measuring attainment. And I trust and hope that this report will provide the evidence that is needed to be able to lay that one to rest, because it would be so fantastic to be able to provide it. So watch us on that journey, because it could get quite bumpy, we're already coming up against the challenges of exactly how you measure something, and also you've got to have your control group who are not experiencing it, and these are children. So how are you actually going to do that? There's lots and lots of really complex things about it, but I am very excited. And there are many other projects where I think that the RSA is beginning to have impact and influence around creativity and cultural learning. The thing that I've been quite picky about, really, is making sure that we don't silo that into one part of what we do. So I am as anxious to make sure that the importance and value of culture is seen within the City Growth Commission, which I didn't feel it was as dominant as it mentioned as much as it needed to be. I'm you know, very keen that that happens in terms of how we're looking at inclusive growth. I think one of the very important things about the RSA is that it brings these things together, that it doesn't look at them as separate things. You know, that we look at creativity and the environment. We look at we don't just sort of put it into education, but we're also looking at how we deal with manufacturing, how we deal with economic success, because I believe that artists should play a full and rounded life in the society that they live in. And whilst they need absolutely the space to be creative people, they are also able to positively influence the world around them. And I think the RSA can be a platform for making sure that happens. But yeah, we're rolling up our sleeves. We're getting right in there on measurement now. So. Attainment, which is
say thank you as well, because we did one of our creative schools host a conversation with Julian and Marcello, and it was really successful, and it was really lovely to see children, young people in the room with our students at the university, with teachers, with Julian and Marcello, and it was a genuine dialogue. So that was good to witness. So thank you.
Yeah, I'm so that's very good.
James, did you put your hand up? No.
Hi, Ed Rogery from Bristol and Bath Regional Capital. So we're a new-ish CIC. We've been trained for 2 years, but I think sort of 5-6 years ago, John to my left and a couple of others from the RSA came up with the germ of the idea. And I guess my question is, as a relatively new fellow of the RSA, is the RSA more about incubating, coming up with very early stage ideas and thought leadership, and then things sort of go off and grow, if you like, in the normal world? Or is it also about scaling ideas where the thought leadership has started with the RSA? And if it's also the latter, what's the best way as a newish fellow that I can maximise my fellowship in the RSA to achieve growth for what I'm working on?
Thank you.
selfish question, but it's a...
No, and probably the last bit of it is the one that the chairman can answer the least best, because of course that would be a good answer for a question for Matthew to answer. But I think the RSA has to be both things. It can't. I hate the word think tank because I don't think it describes us at all. And we're doing a bit of work at the moment talking about what are the words that would describe what we do. But let's use think tank for a minute. But I don't think it is just a think tank. I think it has to also get its hands dirty and do it. Therefore, I think it is right that we have academy schools, and it's right that we see whether the way that we approach education, most of our schools are in very poor parts of the Midlands, whether we can enhance the lives of those kids and really give added value. And it is right that we will do a project on, you know, rehabilitation for ex-offenders and see how that works, or people who are trying to get themselves off being addicted to drugs. But it is also important that we complete those and step away. You know, we are not going to progressively add more and more and more and build a sort of enormous canary wharf of activity. That just isn't what we should be doing. But where we can see that we could practically do an intervention, where that could, that the impact of that could be measured, which is one of the things that the board keeps on going on about, where is what we do, how is our approach going to change it, then I think that we can really demonstrate our value. One of the things that Matthew is working on a great deal at the moment is thinking about how to actually really describe a model of change that would be the RSA's model of change. And we haven't articulated that clearly enough. And I think he's really now growing in this idea. In fact, there'll be a presentation coming at the next board meeting about how could we start to articulate that. So what would the RSA way be? We sort of know it? We feel it in our tummies, but we don't actually really, really describe that. And I think once we've worked that out, then we can start to present ourselves more coherently to a whole group of partners to say how we work together. In terms of a particular project that you want to develop and get support for, then I would pass you on to your local fellows to say they're the ones that can help route you through. Where your project aligns with what our action and research department is doing, then you have an awful lot, you have far greater opportunity to be able to find a way through. But we are committed to wanting to properly and meaningfully engage fellows in the project that we're doing through our action research.
Thank you. Yeah, well, we were named in the Inclusive Growth Report recently, which is great. So that gives us hopefully an opening.
Yeah, because you were pulled out of in the little box, weren't you? Yeah, yeah. No, I thought that was really good. I thought, how great, I'm coming to Bristol, and it was actually legend. Phew.
It's almost like he's been planted.
Yeah, almost like.
Yeah,
thanks
for coming.
Maybe it scrolls around and it changes every day. It's a different city. That's the trouble with them digital reports. You can't trust him, can you?
That's a very good idea, actually. I'll go
And Ed will definitely help you to achieve what it is you need to achieve. Right, some more questions. I think I'm moving across to this side.
Be brave. You've got all sorts of things to ask
about. Oh, we've got a question. Yes, sir.
Where do you think we're at with the debates around the value of culture? Because maybe in my imagination, but it feels like it's gone a bit quiet.
Well, the Warwick Commission on the Future of Cultural Learning was probably the most influential report about that for a very long time, in that it seemed that we made a major step forward with the idea that the cultural and creative industries both needed to work more coherently together to talk to government, but that also government needed to recognise that, you know, you twiddle the knobs on this end and something falls off over there, and that in fact the whole thing is an ecosystem and is interconnected. And I'm still really pleased that every time anybody's writing an article for a newspaper, they seem to go back to the Warwick Commission and check out what the information was on there. So it keeps getting quoted. In fact, I wished I'd called it the Hayward Commission. Big learning lesson in life. The Taylor Report, I think you'll notice. I'm trying to learn now. I thought, yeah, Matthew's not so stupid, is he? There we are. missed my big moment because I don't think I'm going to be chairing another commission. So
get a report or a building named after you. It's very important.
Yes, I haven't got time. I could claim the Hayward Gallery and just go for it. There's a good quote about that actually, where Harold Pinter was a bit upset because they were going to name, whilst he was still alive, they were going to name the Comedy Theatre the Pinter. And then they had a bit of a wobble and they decided to go back and they weren't going to call it the Pinter after all. They were going to continue to have it named the Comedy. And he was apparently, this may be a popcorn, but apparently he was having dinner with Tom Stoppard, and Tom Stoppard said, well, I've got the solution to that. You should just change your name to Mr. Comedy. Which, for anyone who knows comedy, never a more unlikely, incredibly fond of Harold Pinter. He did many of his productions when I was at the Royal Court. That's a big aside. It is now called the Pinter Theatre, but not. Oh. I think he was dead by the time he did it. I don't think it's gone off the boil because of a piece of news about the fact that they have now decided, the government have announced they're going to have an industrial strategy for the art. And culture of the UK. Now, I should like that, shouldn't I, because it was one of the recommendations coming out of the Warwick Commission. But actually, that's really important. If it doesn't get shelved along the way, if we can actually make sure that we have a published bit of paper that really does recognise that the government's role in keeping cultural and creative industries in this country healthy and successful, in the same way as it has industrial strategies for many other important industries in the UK, then that is an enormous step forward psychologically. And it is fascinating now to hear how many times politicians just normally start saying things about the economic benefits and the cultural contribution of the UK. I think it really surprised them, actually, when they saw quite a lot of the statistics, to just realise how unique. I mean, we are an extraordinary country. You know, we're unbeaten in this area. It's really very important to remember it. We are unbeaten in the success of our culture and creative life, and we should be extraordinarily proud of that and make sure that we don't do anything that mucks that position up. So I hope I'm pleased about that industrial strategy. I think that could be very, very.
So it's sinking in.
I think it has sunk in, and I think, it's often reflected by the interests of those people leading the country. And George Osborne was an extraordinary supporter of the arts when he was in power. But I think it is recognised across the political parties now, because the evidence is so clearly there, which is why I think we have to go back to demonstrating the importance of cultural and creative learning in school in terms of how you do in your exam results. We finally got to the point where someone has at the Treasury, God bless them, whoever they were, taken the time to add it all up and say, actually, adds up to a lot of money, and it is of value to the UK that we continue to support it.
Yes, one more question. We've got time for one more.
I guess the title of the RSA, full title of the RSA, is Royal Society of Manufacturing and Arts. So I'm just curious.
And Commonwealth.
So I'm curious about that manufacturing bit. Well, with populism, manufacturing is very much coming to the fore. So I wonder what the strategy, the approach, the projects.
The main lens through which we have been looking at manufacturing has been around this idea of the complete circle, if you like. How do we manufacture things in a way that does not detrimentally affect the environment in which we live? And that's been the particular focus of most of the projects that we've been doing. But I would say that I do think that is broadening now. We've been very interested in working on projects that develop new manufacturing skills, whether we're looking at 3D printing, or other areas where the UK is particularly now pushing forward. Matthew and I first arrived would say, well, it's all very well us talking about manufacturing, but how much are we actually doing these days? Of course, we're now entering into an interesting new world. We're coming out of Europe, where UK manufacturing may start looking quite different. We are redefining it as we go along, but our main focus has been particularly interested in making sure that we are creating an environmentally better world, whether it's, and we've been looking particularly at building projects, working with designers. And I think our relationship with design and manufacturing is probably second to none as an organisation. I'm particularly excited by the increasing interest in the Student Design Awards, and getting young designers working with manufacturers on how to design better for the future. And that does seem to be a programme that's not only really taking off in the UK, but actually could be one of our first really truly global programmes. I mean, we've now got design students from all over the world. I was interviewing people for a particular strand, you know, who are in Hong Kong and Singapore, and there they are down the line, all these great young kids holding up their designs and looking at all their drawings online and all the rest of it. So our relationship to manufacturing through design, I think, is a very interesting route for us to continue to develop.
Thank you. Well, lovely.
Thank you.
Well, I'm just going to say a couple of thank yous, and I'll leave it to you to wind up. I want to say thank you to everybody who came along. Really appreciate it. Lovely to see some people come back again. And we will keep in touch with you as to the conversations coming up in the future. Thank you to Alan and to Lou for organising today and promoting and letting everyone know about it. And thank you very much to Vicky. Thank you for coming down. I really appreciate it. I've really enjoyed it, and I hope everyone else has too.
Thank you.